Hello, Olketa, and welcome to Dateline from RNZ Pacific. Nimbalong me, Dominic Godfrey. Coming up in the program, calls in the Solomon Islands to switch allegiance from Taiwan to China, a New Zealand resident facing multiple murder charges in Fiji, seabed mining controls called for in Papua New Guinea, Cook Islands facing the worst suicide rates on the planet, and a call for youth engagement in disaster preparedness. A Solomon Islands diplomatic task force has recommended severing ties with Taiwan in favour of China. The report, released Friday, comes ahead of a government decision on the matter which observers say could be imminent. Mackenzie Smith reports.
For the past 36 years, Solomon Islands has recognised Taiwan as a staunch ally. But as China's influence across the world grows, it has chipped away at these, dwindling them to just 17, six of which are in the Pacific. The flashpoint is Honiara, where a parliament task force has delivered a report damning ties with Taiwan.
Taiwan has been and always will be USA's pawn in its rivalry with China. Hence, Taiwan may not be allowed to have fully fledged independence. It's unlikely that the US will allow Taiwan to be an independent country.
The report recommends the government set up a diplomatic mission in Beijing, and China should be invited to do so in Honiara. It says this should be formalised by October. The task force says China can provide economic opportunities for Solomon Islands which dwarf those provided by Taiwan, especially in infrastructure. However, in a statement on Friday, Taiwan's foreign ministry says the report is inaccurate and biased, and the task force never visited Taiwan.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs urges all sectors of Solomon Islands to reject the predetermined conclusions of the report and the debt trap they may lead to.
Solomon Islands has not yet said when a formal decision will be made. A spokesperson for the Prime Minister said late Monday that leaders were still meeting over the issue. A government minister who leads a bloc supporting Taiwan, Rick Ho, last month said a vote in Parliament was unlikely to happen this year. But with the release of the task force report, observers say that deadline could be pushed ahead. The deputy opposition leader, Peter Kenny-Laurier Jr., says Cabinet plans to decide before a Foreign Relations Committee has delivered its own report on Taiwan ties. An academic with the Taiwan Strategy Research Association, Fabrizio Bozzato, says it's all but over for Taipei.
I would say that it appears ineluctable that the Solomons will become a new latest diplomatic ally of Beijing. That will leave Taiwan with five diplomatic allies in the Pacific Islands.
A senior lecturer in security studies at Massey University, Anna Pals, says a diplomatic switch would be a win for China's image in the Pacific.
And certainly that will be seen as having implications. Australia and others will see that as having potential implications for how China is seeking to reshape the regional order in its favour.
With the decision looming, Solomon Islands media reported on Monday that Taiwan officials had been dispatched to Honiara for talks. Meanwhile, the Solomon Islands Police Commissioner is appealing for calm as people await an announcement from the government. This is Mackenzie Smith.
Huge crowds gathered at the Nandi Magistrates Court yesterday after Fiji police charged a man in relation to the mysterious family deaths 3 weeks ago in the Nausori Highlands. The bodies of Nirmal Kumar and his wife Usha Devi, their daughter and two granddaughters, were found last month at the top of perilous cliffs, having disappeared 2 days earlier. A distraught baby girl was found nearby on the cliff edge, more than 30 kilometres from where their car was left. As Jenny Meyer reports, Fiji police arrested a man over the weekend and he appeared in court yesterday morning.
On a Monday morning 3 weeks ago, a farmer in Fiji's Nausori Highlands found the dehydrated and sunburnt one-year-old crying next to five bodies at the top of a steep cliff. Police reportedly detained two Christchurch residents who are Fiji citizens at the airport soon after the discovery, and after 48 hours in custody, released them with a stop departure order barring them from travel. Since then, the couple have been under virtual house arrest next door to the remaining family of the dead in the village of Lingalinga near Nandi. Now, one of the pair, Mohammed Rahesh Isuf, has been charged with the alleged murder of the five family members and denied bail. Fiji police made an announcement on Facebook.
Investigators have charged the person of interest in relation to the deaths of the family of five from Lingalinga Nandi. The accused, who is a holder of permanent resident status in New Zealand, has been charged with five counts of murder and one count of attempted murder. He will be produced at the Nandi Magistrates Court today.
Post-mortem findings from the Fiji police indicate possible poisoning with a substance thought to be ingested by the family. There were no reported signs of physical assault. The baby's mother, Sangeeta Devi, said before the arrests that she was living in fear next to the suspect, who the family had known for decades.
So I've requested the Fiji police to patrol at night so that we can at least, you know, be here safe at night. Like daytime, plenty of people are here, but we don't know at night. He has not just hurt me, my whole family, the whole nation has been shocked. We all want justice. The whole nation, PGY, want justice for my family.
She says it's unbelievable that she lost five members of her family at once, and she is really missing them. A brother and uncle of the dead, Raj Kumar, was among many people who turned up as news of the charges broke and says there's huge public anger in Fiji over the deaths. He was also at the police station on Saturday when he learnt there was progress with police bringing another 48-hour detention on their suspect prior to laying charges.
There was a last interview for the little girl. So we were in the station and police told me that we have been already arrested him and he was in the custody.
Raj Kumar says the attempted murder charge relates to the so-called miracle baby found with the bodies.
Attempted murder is like the little girl was found near the body. Five charges will be the dead one, the family dead, plus one was a little girl. She was from Australia. She was found on a body, on the dead body. So that's attempted murder. So there is six charges.
Raj Kumar says the family has had to be so patient and is now very happy their neighbour is in custody and will face justice, although the suspect's wife is still at large. But he says he has confidence in the police investigation.
Police, they got all the evidence, everything, because we went yesterday where the scene was done. We went there and we have to thank the lady who feed the baby since they found. So we have been gone there and we just give a gift to them.
The man has been denied bail and the case has been deferred to the High Court in Lautoka with an appearance expected next Wednesday. Raj Kumar says he believes the man in custody may yet face other significant charges. This is Jenny Meyer.
The former governor of the Papua New Guinea province of Madang, Sir Arnold Ahmet, wants the government to apply strict controls to any future prospects of seabed mining. The James Marape government is backing the Pacific call for a 10-year moratorium on the practice, but Sir Arnold says it needs to go further. This comes as Canadian company Nautilus, in which the PNG government has a 15% stake, is fighting through the courts for its economic survival. Nautilus had been close to beginning operations at its Solwara 1 site in PNG's Bismarck Sea. Sir Arnold told Don Wiseman he wants the government to draw up policies to properly govern the sector and to cancel and withdraw the Nautilus contracts to ensure they cannot be unsold.
We understand that Nautilus is in the process of seeking refinancing and still retains the licenses as its assets, and court proceedings in Colombia, Canada are proceeding. So the potential for those licenses to be transferred sold could result in that project plus other licenses for exploration continuing unless the government determines the policy more specifically. And this is the call on the government. Whilst the Prime Minister has expressed support for moratorium, quite obviously that needs to be translated into a policy position with our new government. And of course, its attempt to seek to redeem the funds that we have committed towards that project. So in the long term, term, our preference, quite obviously, is for cancellation of those licenses and a total ban until such time as science can truly satisfy us that that is a worthwhile and an economically and environmentally sustainable project. At the moment, there is no such evidence. And so our preference as a country, the combined churches and civil society and the warriors that I joined and many, many more people as well in the whole country don't support this project. And so we are confident and hopeful that the Murabe government will progressively review this policy. There is no legislation in place as well.
You've been a lawyer and a judge. In terms of just cancelling those contracts, how easy is it to do that?
I think the government needs to review the conditions of the grant of the licenses. Obviously, it's a contract, it's a property and an asset that's been vested in Nautilus. And in the circumstances of the company now on the verge of bankruptcy and reneging on our contribution as a country, 15% equity that we had taken out, to review all of that. And I think the government is doing that presently, seeking legal counsel and brief counsel to participate in the legal proceedings in Canada at the present time, as we read and understand. So I expect that the new treasurer with the Attorney General and the new Prime Minister will seek appropriate advice going forward as to its ability to revisit and review that particular transaction. I think the legal eagles are probably addressing the mind to it at the present, as we understand the state enterprise that holds the equity, the Skumul Minerals holding on behalf of the state, has got legal counsel to seek to salvage what we can from the current court proceedings.
You were governor at the time that that this legislation allowing Solwara to begin exploration, when that went ahead and then when the government also bought into it, how did this company manage to put it across the PNG government?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that I've taken a great interest in not just this, but a whole range of development contracts dealing with third world developing countries. And one of our challenges, a major challenge, is our capacity, our human resource capacity, professional capacity to monitor the kinds of agreements that are negotiated initially through the bureaucracy and ultimately through the ultimate policymakers of government. Oftentimes, flies under the radar. Only the immediate decision makers sometimes are fully briefed, and often caucuses, whether in government or in parliament, might all be just informed, and decisions are taken without a full knowledge of everything that transpires. And as you know, currently the new Prime Minister and his leadership have made attempts to review an immediate past contracts on natural gas and so on. So I think those circumstances that oftentimes decisions are expedited, fast-tracked through the decision-making process without everybody being fully informed. And this particular project, there's no legislation in place, there was no policy, but the parties, including our government, relied on and were persuaded to rely on the Terrestrial Mining Act. And so currently the Mining Act review is seeking to insert provisions for deep sea mining plus, I think, geothermal energy exploration as well. So that's how that flew under the radar. And then again, with the equity that we were required to acquire, it was 30%, but the government was only willing to acquire 15%. It was taken to arbitration in order to extract that 15%, some 400 million kina worth, towards that project. So those circumstances does suggest to us that it was not entirely transparent, and given the uncertainty of the science and so on, that's where it just avoided transparency and scrutiny by many of us.
Former Madang Governor Sir Arnold Ahmet. The suicide rate per capita in the Cook Islands is worse than in New Zealand, according to NGO Te Kāinga o Pātaunga. The mental health organisation is led by Mariana Taikoko, who says 2 to 3 Cook Islanders are taking their lives every year. Mrs Taikoko marked World Suicide Prevention Day last week by spreading awareness about the problem in the Cooks, where she says mental illness is stigmatised. She told Ben Robinson-Drawbridge the suicide problem is at its worst at the end of the year.
We had a look at the stats, and we noticed The highest rates are these months, November, December, January. And those are the months when we have a lot of activity. Family, things like the weddings, the unveilings, the reunions. We tend to leave all these things to the end of the year, where everybody is actually tired. You know, you've been working all the year all around. And there's the financial, you know, worries and the stress. Well, you need some money for, you know, for the festive season, you know, Christmas coming up. And but then you've got all these other commitments that you've got to contribute to. What we need, of course, is we need to change that, make changes there, and spread out these commitments throughout the year, not leave everything to the end of the year.
Talking about families and the pressure that is generated within families, I'm wondering how families traditionally have reacted to mental illness in the Cook Islands.
Well, there's a shame thing. I think it's really the stigma attached to mental illness. But that's actually getting better. You know, people, the more knowledge they people have reduces that stigma. But then, that's the way we need ongoing, you know, awareness and education. And we have these awareness programs that we, around World Suicide Prevention Day, I think since 2000, we've been doing something. And the other thing we do then is to, we run an annual basic mental health course for frontliners, teachers, doctors and nurses, police, prison wardens, church leaders, simple basic course to help them understand signs, symptoms of mental health issues or illnesses. And also provide them with some skills, you know, basic skills in interviewing and counseling, basic counseling skills. So they're able to help somebody in crisis. And also they'll be able to see whether they need professional help and to refer them.
So do you think that there is adequate treatment in the Cook Islands for people who are suffering from mental illness?
We have adequate treatment here. But the problem is, the difficulty is getting people to come early. All complicated by the people now tend to use, especially the young ones, self-medicate on alcohol and other drugs to make them feel better when they're having mental health issues. So they end up with addiction problems. So we don't have, you know, the addiction services for those, you know, in the Cook Islands. And this is what we encourage people, you know, if you're not again showing signs of early mental health issues, come and see the doctor. Come in for an assessment. But because it's with the problem with the stigma, of course, they won't. You know, they go into denial or they say, oh, no, everything's okay. Until it becomes a crisis. And then when it becomes a crisis, then you need, like, acute care. And we don't have an acute unit here.
Mariana Taikoko. And Te Kahinga o Pā Taunga provides a confidential counselling service. The phone number is 20162. There's a call in Fiji for young people to be included in training on disaster preparedness. This was an issue raised during a workshop considering the revamp of legislation on disaster management practices in Fiji. The NGO, Ignite for Change, says education in disaster preparedness through the schooling system would enhance skills, improve knowledge, and provide support and opportunities for youth. Don Wiseman spoke with Ignite for Change's Broderick Mervin.
We have to recognize that young people have always been at the forefront before, during, and after natural disasters, and that young people have often been left out of the conversation when it comes to disaster management and planning. And this is not evident in the context of Fiji, but across the Pacific region. I mean, the Pacific has had several tropical cyclones and other natural disasters. But often when these disasters do strike, we see a lot of young people getting engaged. And often at times when it comes to the decision-making, young people and children have been left out of the conversation. By having these education initiatives for young people and children, it equips them to become better prepared in terms of emergencies and also disaster preparedness.
So what sort of things are you going to teach them at school?
Well, we're hoping to have capacity building trainings for young people. I think young people need to be empowered with the relevant relevant information that is happening around them in the context of natural disasters. And I think in the context of Ignite for Change, we've done a couple of trainings with young people, not only on good governance, but also on natural disasters, what to do during the course of a natural disaster, and what do you do post that natural disaster. So from our perspective in Ignite for Change, we're hoping to have more capacity building trainings, also engaging with our local authorities in Fiji's context with the National Disaster Management Office, just to see if we can come up with new initiatives to engage young people as well as children.
This came up when you were looking at the old legislation on disaster preparedness. Is this a big element of what you think needs to change?
Look, we've just recently had the review of the Natural Disaster Act of 1998, and I can tell you with all sincerity that as much as we'd like to say that it's a perfect legislation, there's still gaps that need to be addressed. And one of the gaps that must be addressed is young people's engagement in regards to natural disasters. And often at times, young people have been left out of that discussion, and the decision-making with regards to the NDMO Act of 1998 is that young people are sort of the last people to be attended to, or the last people that the National Disaster Management Office and other agencies look into. So young people have often been left behind. And we're trying to achieve, in terms of the global world, we're trying to achieve an agenda, the SDGs, yeah? In terms of the agenda for 2030. Now, how can we achieve that when young people, and also in Ignite for Change, we look at grassroots communities. How can young people in grassroots communities get engaged in decision-making when they're not even involved in the process? We're sort of the last ones to get engaged. And I think that's something that must be addressed. And we've given our ideas and suggestions at that workshop, but we're still awaiting a decision on if our ideas have been reciprocated in the new law that will come into place.
Broderick Mervin of Ignite for Change, ending this edition of Dateline from RNZ Pacific. Now, there's plenty more at our website. Head to rnzi.com. I'm Dominic Godfrey. Thanks very much for listening. Kia manuia.